There's a strange promise hidden inside numbers. We're taught that if we measure something carefully enough, count it, rank it, and track it, then we'll finally understand it. Progress will become visible, improvement will feel real, life will make sense, and sometimes that works. But sometimes numbers quietly change the question we're answering. Today's episode starts with a rock climber in a university gym. He's not a superhero climber and not a peak-bagging adrenaline junkie. Just a tired person who thought climbing was going to be all about brute force and range, and instead discovered something much stranger. They discovered elegance. I'm Autumn Phaneuf, and on this episode of Breaking Math, we're joined by Ti Nguyen, a professor at the University of Utah, and we're here to talk about his latest book, The Score, where we explore how discovery opens doors to much larger questions, especially what happens when The Score stops being a tool and starts telling us who we are. Now, tell us a little bit about your background and what inspired the book.
So the book comes from two directions. One of the specialties I've had, the really weird specialty I have in philosophy, is philosophy of games. My first academic book was a book called Games, Agency as Art that was trying to explain what games were and what made them special. And part of this was about how point systems sculpted what we did in games, how point systems, like everything from like how we score points in basketball to like what gives you experience points in an indie tabletop role-playing game, how that changes the nature of your action, how that shapes what you do. That's half of what I've been doing. And the other half is trying to understand how information flows in a society. I work in a field called social epistemology, which tries to understand how knowledge gets made, how trust gets sculpted, and how information gets transferred socially. And on that side, I've been really interested in the nature of metrics. And I mean, at my first job, I was for a long time the learning outcomes liaison for my philosophy department, which meant that I was supposed to report in clear, crisp, quantified form, objectively true metrics for how well we were teaching people philosophy. And I started worrying a lot about the basic dynamic of metrics in an institution and what got captured and what didn't. And what actually happened was, for a while, I realized that out of my game stuff, I had this picture of how clear, explicit scoring systems were like the gateway to play, to joy, to discovering new narratives, to discovering new kinds of action. And then I had another story from the other half of my work about how institutional scoring systems that were clear and explicit missed everything that was important and sucked the life out of education, art, and community. And then I realized these two pictures were deeply in tension, and I had to explain to myself how these two things could be and how I could square how different scoring systems were in two different parts of my life.
I find that to be very interesting. That makes me think of the show Matlock, and it's like, both things can be true.
Both things can be true.
Both things can be true.
Yeah. Understanding the fine difference is the important.
Absolutely. Now, when you start the book, you open it with rock climbing, and it's a moment where you felt not great, right?
Yeah. Yep.
You were anxious, overworked, kind of at war with yourself.
Yeah.
Now, why did you start there, and what did you think that climbing was going to give you, and what did it give you instead?
Yeah. I mean, climbing is a really interesting case for me as one of the most positive interactions with a scoring system I can think of. The two places I tried to start were my best and worst experience with a scoring system. So climbing is super interesting because climbing is a case study for me in how much I didn't understand the value of an activity. Like until I found climbing in my mid-20s, I was a disembodied life of the mind intellectual. I like basically destroyed my body for the sake of reading and like being on the computer. I didn't find any value in bodily movement at all. What I basically thought was I needed to get some exercise. There were some minimum calories I had to burn. And it was this thing that I was supposed to do to meet some external standard. And that was it. And then I wandered into climbing. And then climbing is a really interesting game because it has both a clear restriction, which is you're not supposed to use any tools, you're not supposed to use ropes to go up, you're not supposed to use like spikes or grappling hooks, you're just supposed to use your hands and your feet. And then it has the scoring system that tells you that you get the victory is getting to the top, and then things are graded by difficulty. And so for the first time, I was plunged into this activity where the path to victory was being subtler with my body and being more creative with my body. And climbing is like very weirdly amplifying, right? Like I mean, before I started climbing, I had no idea where my hips were at any moment. And climbing tells you to climb this really delicate, difficult thing. And if you lose track of where your hips are, you fall off. So it became this like what it was telling me to do, the scoring system it was giving me, and the way it punished me for failing were this feedback loop that like attenuated me to both my body and then to like this new thing I had never experienced before, which was how beautiful it could be to be just like lost in like subtle, interesting movement. That was a journey into a different kind of value that I got pushed into because of a game with a hyper simple victory condition.
Now, you just didn't ever describe that as adrenaline. It's solving these various puzzles.
One of the interesting things about climbing was it was exactly this. So before I started climbing, my image of climbing is either like a strength bro or adrenaline sport or a thrill-seeking sport. And I was completely wrong. Climbing is like delicate puzzle solving. And one of the things you find in and around climbing is a lot of philosophers love climbing. A lot of mathematicians love climbing. My spouse is a chemist. I took her climbing. Just like any kind of like tiny technical puzzle-solving mentality just gloms onto that. But instead of doing it like in my head, I was doing it with my body. I think one of the background thoughts for the entire book is that the value of things is often subtle and not clear on their face. And when you're not in it, you can get it wrong. And when you're not in climbing, it doesn't make sense to you why it would be so clarifying and beautiful. And you have to immerse yourself in it. And then once you do that, you totally see why. You totally see why people, especially people that like games and puzzles, would just be drawn to this thing.
Absolutely. Now, after that, you talk about something very modern that's sneaking in. And it's because even in something physical and joyful as climbing, we start keeping scores, right? So very quickly, climbing introduces grades, numbers, rankings, levels. And at what point did you notice the numbers starting to matter?
It's super interesting. The numbers always matter to me for climbing. And for a long time, they actually helped. This is why I think climbing is such an interesting example for me, because there's a certain really simple thing you can say here, like scoring systems are bad, competitiveness is bad, ranking systems are bad. And that wasn't my experience with climbing. My experience with climbing was, for a really long time, for years, the kind of clear, simple, external scoring system of climbing that came from other people actually showed me a new kind of beauty I hadn't experienced before. And it was because the scoring system was built along this kind of arcane difficulty that I was too inexperienced to know about. And that happened for years. And then at some point it stopped working. So I think I'd been climbing for like 5 years. And then I hit, I think, the wall for both my body and time, you know, professor, parent, almost no time. And it suddenly turned out at that point that following the standard difficulty ranking stopped giving me the thing it was giving me before. It started becoming grueling. It started becoming miserable. And so I ended up having to basically, I think of it as like reconceiving the scoring system. Like I had to step back from the given one and think like, no, I needed to be doing something else. So what I've ended up doing is actually trying to find moderate difficulty climbs and then try to do them as beautifully and elegantly as possible, which is which is my own version of, it's a homebrew scoring system. And I think like the standard scoring system got me into the space, taught me how to be a climber in general. And then at some point when it stopped working for me, I had to find my own like peculiar remix of the scoring system that still has some relation to the original.
At some point, when you're thinking about the score, you just have to savor that moment. And I'm curious, you talk about sheer wood in the book a little bit. Why did that land so hard for you?
There's also this weird paradox. So Sherwood is one of the people I started climbing with. And there was a time where I was obsessed with just like getting the next climb, like ticking it off, like counting as having the next score, and I wasn't savoring the movement. And he was the one that told me, he was like, no, you have to not just focus on whether or not you're winning. You have to focus on how your body is feeling, and you have to savor the moment. So there's one important thing, which is that over obsession with the scoring system can kind of pull you out of this. But I think there's another part of this puzzle too, which is if you ignore the scoring system completely, you might never have gotten into the situation in the first place. And you might never have guided yourself in the first place in the way that would put you, like, over obsession with the scoring system blocks me from that kind of beauty. If I had never encountered it and never tried to win on those terms, I also never would have experienced that kind of beauty.
So that essentially changes the way that you think of winning. So get rid of just a score, just a number. Take that, and it kind of asks you, what do you want as an outcome? And that changes it for you to essentially win, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the crucial distinction for thinking about games is thinking about the difference between the goal of a game and the purpose of a game. So the goal of a game is the thing you're aiming at doing during the game, and the purpose of the game is why you play it. The larger purpose, like the larger reason, and sometimes they're the same. Some people just want to win because they want to win. Like some people want to win at poker to make money. But the goal of climbing is to get to the top of the climb and to get to the top of more difficult climbs. And my purpose for climbing is to clear out my mind and soul and to experience beauty in my body. Or there are party games I play where in order to have fun, you have to try really hard to win. But the reason you're playing is to chill out and have a good time. And even if you lost and had a good time and relaxed and enjoyed yourself with your friends, then you actually did the thing. Like you did what you wanted. You did what you actually cared about. But the weird puzzle of games is in many cases, you can't aim for that purpose directly. I can't just go to the rock wall and be like, time to relax. It's not going to happen. I have to focus. Ew. I can't go to a party and be like, let's chill out and relax. No. The weird thing that works is you have to focus on winning at like Twister or charades. And that's the magic happens via that route. But if you over-focus on winning, then you won't have fun. So it's like this weird, mostly but not perfect absorption where you're mostly trying to win, but also kind of step back realizing that winning is the goal, but not the purpose.
Now, changing topic just a little bit here. At one point in the book, when you're talking about games, you do something really important. Now you give this feeling a name because once something has a name, you can finally see it. You call this value capture.
Right.
When things are simplified, metrics quietly replace richer values. Yeah. Now, why is this so hard to notice while it's happening?
Right. Great question. So value capture is what happens when, so it's a term I invented for this book. And for me, value capture is what happens when your values are rich and subtle or in the process of developing that way. And you get put in a simplified, you get put in an institution or a social setting that offers you simplified, typically quantified versions of those values. And then the simplified ones take over. So going to school out of a love of education or learning and coming out obsessed with your GPA, or going into academia because you are fascinated by philosophical questions and then coming out obsessed with your citation rates and the status of the journals you're published in, or becoming a journalist or a podcaster to communicate something interesting and then becoming obsessed with your subscriber count or your page views or your follower count. Or, I think another really clear case is starting some fitness program for the sake of feeling better and being more fit, and then coming out obsessed with step counts or your weight or your BMI. So in all of these cases, there's this gap between what actually matters and how we measure it. The way that we measure things in institutions, which is going to be the heart of what we need to talk about to understand value captures, has this basically simplifying force. And your question was, why is it hard to notice? And it's really like, I don't know, it's really in some sense, it is very puzzling. Like, right? Like, I'm in this for health. I'm in this for fun. I'm in this for love. And then at the end of the day, like, I went into philosophy because the questions were exciting to me and they were thrilling. And by the end of my graduate career, in which I had been fully value captured by the status and ranking system inside my profession, I was working on boring crap that I did not care about, because it would get me highly ranked publications. It might be getting me more citations and more countable status, right?
Yeah.
So and you see, and it's also like the dumbest place to do it. Like, why do the most idiotic thing possible, which is devoting your life to philosophy, only to end up doing something boring to advance up some external ranking system? I mean, it's kind of, I think, to me, an unsolved puzzle psychologically of why we do this. There's a ton of sociology and a ton of anthropology and a ton of history that has observed the way that human beings just orient so quickly towards these systems. I have a few theories. One is that they just speak louder, right? It's really when you have, on the one hand, something like a measure like weight loss or more citations or greater return on investment. And on the other side, you have something so like weirdly, I mean, actually, let me give you a more controversial example. This is an example I've been really interested in for public health decisions since during the COVID pandemic. I think there was a collision between two values. One value is the value of saving lives, which is very, very easy to count publicly. And the other set of values are values having to do with mental health, maintaining community, maintaining various kinds of traditions. And it's not like I'm saying saving lives isn't important. But what I'm saying is there was a complex balancing act. And instead of engaging that complex balancing act, a lot of the times it was really easy just to optimize for lives saved and to ignore everything else because one of those things was very clearly countable. People are going to be mad about me for this example. But I mean, other examples are just like, I mean, another example that's pretty close is food and nutrition. It's really easy to say saturated fats are associated with higher heart attack rates. And there's no easy count for like, yes, but they're a delicious part of longstanding, beautiful culinary traditions, and they make me happy. And one of these things, there's some effect where the simplicity and clarity of the count, both internally and in external systems of justification, just seems to like speak louder. And that's the thing that just, that's the best explanation I have for it. It just seems to ring louder in people's heads and capture our attention.
Absolutely. But at one point, that shift almost feels painful. We start it for one reason, that goal, and then you add this additional value capture. I'm just going to throw this example out. Even think for marketing, right? Yeah. Say your goal is like 10,000 followers on a social media platform, and you get to that ranking, and then what? Because now those rankings subtly rewrite what we felt when we were thinking about our outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, maybe let me try this way of putting it. One of the interesting things for me about value capture is what's changing in you is your standards for evaluating success. And that's why it's so pernicious, right? Like, I think that it would be, here's a fine way to interact with clear external metrics. Let's say I take a Fitbit. I'm like, this will help me get exercising. This will help me feel good. And then I use it for a while. And then I check in and I'm like, is this still helping me feel good? And if the answer is yes, I keep doing it. And if the answer is no, right? Not just feel good, but like functionality. I actually knew someone whose knees were starting to hurt from walking too much, and they like wore out their knees to hit their step counts, right? So if you have an evaluative stance that's distinct from the simplified metric, it becomes easier to be like, oh, this isn't doing the thing. The problem is a lot of the times the metric itself is very clear and loud. And then the thing that should be on top, the thing that should be authoritative, our value system, a lot of those signals are really quiet. And a lot of those signals look to me like signals of like feeling happy, feeling satisfied, feeling bored, like noticing that you're disengaged, noticing that you are full of, that doing one kind of activity makes you full of life and doing something else makes you feel dead inside. And if the metrics are particularly loud enough, then it becomes easy to ignore the quiet voice of joy and sorrow. And then you don't have a standpoint to correct a bad metric from. It was like, if a bad metric captures the way you evaluate how things are going, then you'll just be like, it doesn't matter if I'm miserable. Look, I've got more numbers. It doesn't matter if what I'm saying is crap. Look, my numbers are higher, right?
I think something like that is more of a standard engineering perspective instead of just something that humanizes your scores.
Can you say more about what the standard engineering perspective is?
So I would say you hit that goal, you hit that number, you don't have to feel it. It's just looking at like a KPI dashboard.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're looking at your metrics of what you want to attain, sometimes we don't even think about the outcomes or the greater picture of something that it's what it's going to humanize.
Yeah, I mean, the really interesting question for me became, I mean, there's a conversation you can ask about this sometimes where first thing is for me to say, like, look, if you pay attention to these metrics, you'll miss what's really important. And the response is, oh, the problem here is those are just bad metrics. We just need to build better metrics that better capture what's really important. And I think the thing that I've been slowly figuring out with the help of a lot of really interesting scholarship, especially from a field called science and technology studies, is that there is a deep reason why we should expect metrics to fail to reliably capture what's really important and what's humanly important because of the way that metrics and other kinds of data systems are built at institutional scale. That there's some profound tension between the ways that large bureaucracies and large collections of people can keep track of things together and what's really important.
Absolutely. Now, let's zoom out on this picture a little bit more. And I love how you just didn't stop at climbing or academia, for examples in the book. You also start noticing patterns everywhere. And that's really when games enter the picture, yeah. Right? So when you're scoring systems, it doesn't just measure behavior, but they tell you kind of what they want in the end. Why are games so upfront about that while real life pretends not to be?
That's a super good question. I mean, there are two things. A scoring system does two things. It tells you what to want, and then it has a reason for being. And I think these are really, we have to keep track of these two different novels. One of the inspirations for a lot of my games work was this moment from my favorite European board game designer, Rainer Knizia. It's like the Mozart of European board game design. And he was a mathematician. And he is a mathematician. He said in a lecture that the most important thing in his game design toolbox was the scoring system, because the point system told the players what to care about. Right? It tells you what desires you need to take on to play the game. And if you actually look at his games, he's like this extraordinary artist of interesting different scoring systems. So, for example, there's one of his great games, Tigris and Euphrates. You're collecting in four different colors, right? Have you played Tigris?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, like, you're collecting in four different colors. And in other games, you would be aiming at whatever you are aiming to collect the most of one thing or to collect the most overall. And he tells you that you have to collect four different colors and your score at the end of the game is whichever color you have the least of. And suddenly this completely transforms. You're now trying to maintain a balanced portfolio. Now you're like hyper-focused on your weakness. Now you, instead of just being able to optimize for one good color, you have to be like, okay, what's my weakness? Then you have to look at other people. They're like, oh, what's their weakness? They might be strong in everything, but they don't have much green. God, I can block them in green. And so that little bit of the scoring system orients you during the game. So that's level one. The second thing is that I think game designers use scoring systems to get people for some other purpose. And what that purpose is in games, usually that purpose is fun or interestingness, but in other places, it's something different. So I've become really convinced especially by a paper called Making the Grade, The History of the A to F Marking Scheme in American Education, that grades in America, we actually know that clear ranked grading systems tend to decrease student education, right? Students tend to hyper-focus on tests, hyper-focus on grades, stop learning out of curiosity, stop exploring, and stop learning anything that won't get them to the grade. So it's very clear that that scoring system doesn't serve the purpose of happiness or the purpose of education. What purpose does it serve? It seems pretty clear from their analysis that it serves the purpose of employers, and in particular, employers looking to be able to readily hire employees that can be certified to serve some purpose so that they can fire people and hire new people at will to perform a particular function. So it served. So there's a scoring system where I think what it's telling students to do is study for the test, but what it's the true purpose it serves, its real interest, is creating an easily employable, interchangeable workforce for large-scale corporate interests. Okay, so your big question was, why is this so clear in games and why is it so hidden in institutions? There's a lot of reasons for this, but I think one of the biggest in games is games surface it because games are temporary and different. I mean, part of the center of what a game is. So one of the core ideas from the scholarship of games that comes from an early 20th century anthropologist named Johann Huizinga is that what games are and what play is something that occurs in a magic circle. And what a magic circle is a space and time that's detached from ordinary life, where you transition into it and you take on different roles and different goals. You know, like my spouse and I are loving and supportive of each other, and then we pick up a board game and now we're murdering each other. Right? Now we're out to destroy each other. And then the game ends and then it's over. It doesn't matter. I mean, whether, you know, she blocked my great move and destroyed my plans. That's isolated to the game. And because they're isolated, we can have so many of them. I think one of the huge differences is that a lot of people have never reflected on what GPA is and what it can do, because what the grading system can do, because they've never experienced any alternative. If you've lived your entire life inside one pervasive scoring system, I think it's often, it becomes an the way that some of the science and technology studies people put it is that when a technology or a way of thinking becomes pervasive, it becomes infrastructure and it goes into the background. You just start to assume that's the only way things could be. But the experience of games is very different. You're constantly moving between scoring systems and seeing how little changes radically change the experience. I've been currently like obsessed with indie tabletop role-playing games and just...
Yes.
Right? Is this okay?
It's not just you. It's not just you.
Good. Give me the background of that. Yeah.
Of course. I'm a competitive Magic the Gathering player, like top 8, constantly ranked. I play Magic the Gathering. One of my friends ended up doing, it's called Isekai Realms, and they create a scenario and you roleplay as yourself. And this has even gone to Dragon Con. Hey, Chris. Yes, I'm putting in a plug for you mid-show, dude.
Have you played games like...
Go ahead.
Do you know games like Apocalypse World and Fate and Lady Blackbird and Blades of the Dark?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
A little bit. I'm not like always playing it, but I am familiar.
If you want to talk about why, this is such a good question. Why has it become surfaced? You can actually have this. A lot of us had a mirror of this experience with Dungeons and Dragons. So I played Dungeons and Dragons for much of my childhood and it was fine. It was good. We had some good times. We had a lot of slow times, but you kind of assume if that's the only system you've ever played, that's the only way things could be. And then I become fascinated with this set of indie designers who started screwing with the point and rule systems. One of the problems I had growing up that these people helped me articulate with Dungeons and Dragons is you may have a low intelligence score, but nothing motivates you to play dumb, right? You just have low rolls. On the other hand, Fate gives you these characteristics. You might be stubborn, you might be a drunkard, you might be impetuous, and it gives you points for screwing up in character. And then you can use those points to activate those same characteristics to get bonuses on rolls, right?
Of course.
Or Lady Blackbird, the rule where you get back your stamina points by inventing shared backstory and character. Once you experience rule sets like this, you start to see how finally tiny, tiny little rules changes can completely change your experience of the game. And tiny little scoring system changes can completely change your experience of the game. And it's hard to be complacent when you realize how much variety there is and how much the specific detail of the scoring system matters for your experience.
Of course. I'm just thinking about also at one point when you're talking about these different experiences, you have something called achievement play versus striving play.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious, why do striving players care intensely about the moment, but not afterwards?
Okay. So the definition of games I'm using comes from a philosopher named Bernard Suits. And he says that what a game is to play a game is to voluntarily take on unnecessary obstacles to create the possibility of struggling against them. One way to put it is that in games, obstacles are a central part of the value, right? So he thinks in non-game life, we just have some thing we're trying to do. Like, I'm trying to get to this particular point in space, and I just do it as efficiently as possible by any means necessary. But in a game, we get a restriction. So if you're running a marathon, you're supposed to get to a particular point, but you have to do it under a lot of restrictions. No shortcuts, no cars, no bicycles, right? But the point is, it doesn't count as crossing the finish line of a marathon unless you did it under certain restrictions. So this shows you that the struggle is central to the value. So what you're talking about, this difference between achievement and striving play, is something that it's the center of my first book on games. And what I was trying to say was that there was that if you read Suits, one of the things you can see is that even within games, there are two different motivational postures. You can be an achievement player or a striving player. So an achievement player is someone who cares about a game for the sake of the win. The reason they play is they want to win. They have to win a certain way. Like if you're competitive in marathon running, you want to win at marathons, right? You want to win by running, but what you want is to win at running. A striving player is someone whose main value is to be immersed in the process, in the struggle itself. And they don't actually care about the win, but in order to have that immersion, they have to temporarily care about the win, right? So me, yes, rock climbing, I don't actually care about getting to the top. I just need to clear my head and relax and chill down. But I can't do that unless I actually focus with all my might and want to, like, I can't relax unless I get absorbed, and I can't get absorbed unless I really want to get to the top. And so I have to get myself to want to get to the top. But that's just temporary, right? One way to put it is that in ordinary life, we take the means for the sake of the end. But in game life, we take the ends for the sake of the means, if that makes sense.
Like, yes,
we try to win to have a struggle. So that's just some of us. So you ask, like, what is it? Why is it temporary? This is just like, I don't think you have to be this way. No one has to be a striving player. But a mark of a striving player is that your interest in winning is only temporary. So I think, like, here's an example of a place where I'm a striving player. So my spouse and I play a lot of board games, and we're very, very differently skilled. So she is a chemist, and she is incredibly good at spatial manipulation, precise math, and geometric work. And I am an asshole, and I am good at manipulation and deceit and screw and, like, making moves that confuse people. Like, I remember playing one time against a person in chess, and they were like, I sometimes feel like you're just playing to exhaust, like, the logical space for me. I'm like, yes, actually, that's what I'm doing. I know what makes you uncomfortable, and I'm making moves to make you uncomfortable, to attack your resources of, like, energy, right? That is how I play. And you're shaking your head at me.
Like, I would never want to play Magic with you.
I don't like Magic.
You don't like Magic the Gathering?
I prefer Richard Garfield's game that he made right after Magic, Netrunner. Okay, we can have that.
Okay.
There's also this thing, though, where Magic is a game. There are some games, so I was a Go player for a long time, and there are some games that want to take over your entire life, and you get the most out of them if you devote everything to them. And if I were to do that, I would do that with Go. But since I'm not doing that, then I don't, like, as a dilettante, there are many other games that I... And anyway, so in most games, either my spouse or I are naturally better. But once in a while, we find a game where we're evenly matched because the game permits both deceit and geometrical thinking. And then we'll have delicious games, and then I will find a strategy guide. And my spouse will never read strategy guides. So here's the choice I have. Either read the strategy guide and win, or don't. So here's my observation. If I was an achievement player, there's only one rational thing to do. Read the strategy guide and win. I do not read the strategy guide because I want to have interesting fights. So this is to me, what this shows me is that my interest in winning is not galactic. I don't actually deeply want to win because there's an easy way to do that. Read the strategy guide, right? My spouse is not going to do it. But what I actually do is avoid moves that would make me more likely to win in the long term, but to play so that in the game, I can absorb myself in an interest in winning in the short term to have a cool struggle. But that fact, the fact that I avoid reading the strategy guide, I think reveals to me that winning for me is a short-term interest that I use to have an interesting struggle and not like a galactic life-spanning interest. It's not a real value.
Absolutely. Now, I'm curious, when do games stop being safe? Because I know at one point you end up talking about when you have scoring systems, these sometimes will escape the board game and things get really weird.
Yep. I mean, when
can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So there are two things that can escape. One is scoring systems and the other is attitudes. And it's related. So one of the things that makes, I mean, I think here's an easier way to answer it. I can tell you what makes games really safe. So one of the things that makes games safe is that the points of a game are detached from ordinary life. Who gets more points in a board game does not usually, in a normal context, have consequences outside of it, which is why it's okay for me to completely rip apart my spouse's or friend's position in the game and just like end their like resource machine with a brutal blow. Because nothing hangs on that, right? Uh-huh. And that, I mean, that's that between that and the fact that we're in the game voluntarily. So in the ideal case, we have volunteered to be in a game because we all enjoy the struggle and we've agreed to have this particular struggle over essentially meaningless points for the sake of fun. And the interesting thing is we can all have fun even if some of us lose terribly. That is completely different from a case where a scoring system is tied to real-world financial security or real-world goods, and then somebody, I don't know, let's call them Jeff, tries to maximize all out their score, their financial score, and as a consequence, this alters the landscape of financial security for people in the real world. So the answer is what makes games safe is that they're these little artificial environments. And not all games are like this, right? Some games are tied to real world things, and this makes them less safe. The safety comes from their artificiality and their disposability. But if you take that attitude, the most unsafe possible thing is to take the attitude that's permitted in games of being all out, destroy everything, like get as many points as in any way I can, and then take that into, I don't know, the world of finance and screw with the world financial markets and do anything and everything out of hyper-focus on rank, pumping up your financial score.
That is actually, yes. The other example that I would use is also gambling, right? It's the addictive abilities that this has, and you can lose it all.
Yeah. I mean, gambling is a great example because it shows us there's another way the games can be unsafe in a very different way, which is what seems to make games good is that we have the will and the freedom to navigate between them and pick the ones that suit us and make us feel good. And we can be trapped in a game. Some games were bad games. Sometimes we're trapped in bad games because the world forces us to play them. This is why I hate the gamification of education.
Yep.
Don't want to force students to play games on which their careers depend. But another way to do it is to addict people. I mean, one of the big mysteries to me is that you can be wrong about whether you're having a good time. And my experience of this was with the computer game Civilization, which I spent years, months of my life at least, possibly years, convinced I was having a good time, horribly addicted. And then afterwards thinking to myself, no, that I regret that. I have no memory of that. There was nothing but micro-optimization misery for me. And I thought I was having fun, but I was wrong. I think that's
but you're just in the game and just whatever you're doing, it's like hyper-fixating on it.
Yep, yep, yep.
Yep. Now, I think that brings it to the point that sometimes data travels well, but judgment doesn't.
Yes.
Now, are there some kinds of values that simply disappear when portability becomes a top priority?
Yeah. Yeah. This is, I think, when I was starting to write this book, it started out of an instinct. People were like, oh, you love games. You must love the gamification of work and education. And I was like, no. If you actually understand the joy of games and play, you know that's the death. And then I was trying to explain why. And I started thinking in terms of this gap, right? This gap between what's important and what's really valuable. And the worry that when you say things like this, people are always like, oh, that's just bad metrics. Let's fix the metrics. And what I was really interested in was the possibility that metrics inherently miss what's important. And I think I found a really good explanation why metrics, institutional metrics, and institutional data collection systems will invariably miss what is really important in human life.
So you have this idea that data travels well, but judgment doesn't. Now, what kinds of values simply disappear when portability becomes a top priority?
Yeah, that is, I think, the most important question. So one way to think about this whole mess is to think about that what metrics are doing is they are coordinating us. And the way they coordinate us is by ensuring that we're counting the same way together. They're putting us on the kind of like same standardized way of counting, which when we're talking about values is the same standardized way of evaluating. When I was trying to figure out this whole mess and to figure out what was so weird about metrics, about why gamification seemed to miss something, I kept giving these examples of bad metrics. And the responses would always be like, oh, these are bad metrics in particular, but we can fix them. We can make it better, right? We need to close the gap. And Right. What I'm really interested in is the possibility that there is some intrinsic tension between much of what's valuable in our lives and the way that institutions count together. And the thing that taught me the most about this was two particular scholars. One is Theodore Porter, the other is Lorraine Daston. Both of them are from a field called science and technology studies. And they're both historians, actually. And they're both really interested in the social origin of the idea of objectivity. Theodore Porter puts it this way. He says, look, so in his book, Trust in Numbers, he's trying to figure out why politicians and administrators so often reach for quantified justification, even when we know that the metrics are bad. And his answer was to think about the basic different nature of qualitative and quantitative ways of knowing. He doesn't think that either is inherently better or worse. He thinks they're good at different things. And the problem comes when we compulsively reach for the quantitative, even when situations where qualitative knowledge might be more appropriate. So he puts it this way. Qualitative ways of knowing, writing things out in words, is very open-ended, context-sensitive, very reactive, very dynamic. But it travels badly between contexts because it requires a lot of shared background knowledge to understand. So if I write, commentary on my student's paper that responds to what they're trying to do, thinks about the relative creativity versus rigor versus scholarship about the text, that is really meaningful to us in our class context, but it won't travel easily to like the business dean. It certainly won't travel easily to, say, a Silicon Valley hiring person. Because of the open-endedness, all these qualitative reports don't aggregate easily, right? And that's part of what's going on, right? Because each of us is writing along different dimensions, and we've selected the dimensions of importance tailor-made to the particular context, we can't add them up easily because they're not measuring the same thing. In quantitative ways of knowing, and I want to, especially since I know this is a math podcast, and to be really clear, I'm not talking about quantification in principle. I'm talking about quantification as it occurs inside institutions and bureaucracies, right? This is what we're analyzing. He says the way that quantification works in large-scale institutions is that we identify a stable context invariant kernel. Something that can be understood by everyone, no matter their background, from different contexts, from different parts of the bureaucracy, from different parts of the world, we fix it, and then we all collect into the same kernel. So in education, this is letter grades. This is GPA, right? So we fix a really simple set of meanings, A, B, C, D. We all roughly know what they mean. And so when I translate my complex multidimensional thing into a B or a C, someone else can understand it immediately. And because we've stabilized and standardized those meanings, that means we can auto-aggregate, right? We don't have to do any work. Once you enter A and I enter a B, that stuff can sum up. So here is Porter's view. He thinks the heart of quantification as it occurs in institution is that it's designed to travel. It is engineered to be portable and cross contexts. And the way that we engineer data to cross contexts is we remove any nuance or high context sensitivity, and thus we prepare to travel easily. So what Porter taught me, which I think is like It's funny. When I was a young philosopher, it was like, existentialism, the meaning of life, is what horrified me. And now it's like this theory of data, which says that the reason that information, that data, that institutional numbers have social power and are so comprehensible is they've been engineered to be highly comprehensible at scale. And that engineering process essentially involves removing any high context, high nuance, high sensitivity information, anything that requires rich immersion in a particular context to understand. So their power is exactly bound up with their price. It's not like an accident, right? And I think this shows us what's easy to count at scale is exactly those things that are highly portable. And this isn't to say that quantitative ways of knowing screw things up. I think a better way to put it is they're very deadly accurate at getting masses of information about certain kinds of things, which are the kinds of things that everyone can count. So this is one of the reasons why, like, mortality rates, right? Antibiotics, measuring antibiotics, these are really good uses for large-scale data approaches because everyone, like, dead or alive is something that people count pretty much the same. Whether bacteria have left your system or not is, and I just had a horrible infection. Like, whether that infection is there or gone away, that's something that's fairly easy to measure at scale. Whether or not something enriched you or is beautiful or made you happy, that is so context sensitive and so variable that it's exactly the kind of thing that large scale data methods will miss. I mean, one way to put it is that my worry is not about any particular metric. It's about the metrified world, which is only willing to pay attention to things that we can capture in metrics. And one way to put it is, I mean, I know a lot of people right now are worried about algorithmic bias. And I think there's some very important algorithmic biases that are based on one particular error, right? We screwed up in how we set this up. We excluded women. We excluded people of color. But I think there's a deeper inescapable one. And that's the bias of the metrified world towards what's easy to measure at scale. The metrified world will be hyper attentive to things that are sufficiently simple and stable that we can all count them together, and it will tend to systematically sideline, dismiss, and ignore anything that requires high sensitivity or context.
You just spoke about beauty as well. Yeah. Now, if we're looking at beauty or process beauty in our work, oftentimes modern culture struggles with that. Why?
This is, I think, one of the most interesting and hard questions. Let me take a really quick, fast version of this.
That's okay.
Here's a fast pass. I've been really one of the reasons that games are so interesting to me is they're an example of process beauty, of beauties that emerge inside your own actions and that aren't in an object, right? And one quick way, very fast gloss is that object beauty and the kind of stable beauty in objects is easy to sell. It's like, if you think this beauty is in this movie and we can copy the movie, then that's very saleable. But if you think that we have this complex role-playing game and a lot of the beauty emerges from the game stimulates it, but a lot of the thing comes from us, and there's no guarantee. You can buy the same role-playing game and you won't get the same experience because the game is really a design prod to pull something out of you. Less marketable because there's less of a stable guarantee that you'll get the thing.
I think that summarized that well, because usually when we're thinking about connection and beauty and process beauty, right, we're so quick to dismiss something, especially when we have outputs that pile up uselessly.
Oh my God. Okay. So here's a thought I've been obsessed with lately, which is it has seemed to me more and more clear lately that a thing that connects so many of the high arts, the things that we were painting, movies, this is a stability. And part of that stability means that most of our experience of it is reading is not completely passive, but essentially we are reading somebody else's work. We're watching somebody else's work. And then there are these other realms, the realms that normally get labeled low, fan fiction, cosplay, tabletop role playing. And the common feature of all these things that are despised as lowly geek or awful culture is that they're ones where creativity and the process of creation are distributed evenly across a community instead of concentrated in a small number of people and then packaged outwards. And the thing that really helps me understand this is, so Langdon Winner, this philosopher of technology that I find super interesting, he's really interested in the ways that particular technologies kind of transform the social landscape. He's really interested, for example, in how printing presses, no matter whether or not you intended to use them democratically or not, one thing that printing presses do against oral communication is they concentrate the power of communication in whoever is rich enough to own a printing press.
Yes.
And he has this analysis of factories. And he says, okay, there's an essential political nature to a factory. To understand that, think, okay, imagine that we are in a artisanal village of shoemakers. And each of us makes shoes by hand. It's very slow, very inefficient compared to modern standards. But each of us can experiment freely. We can make shoes to our own standard. We can change the way we make shoes each day. I can custom shoes, tailor shoes to you easily, right? I can experiment and adapt to my experimentation. Now, let's say that we take our village of artisanal shoemakers and replace us with a factory and then hire us all back into this factory. I mean, it's going to be much more efficient. We're going to make 10 times as many shoes. But the way that factories work, what makes them more efficient is precisely that people are forced to specialize. And to make the specialization work, the specialization has to be highly coordinated. So if I'm going to make all eyelets and you're going to make all soles and someone else is going to make all the shoelaces, we have to make sure the eyelets match the holes punched in the shoe. And we have to make sure that whoever's making the upper, that will fit precisely with the sole, which means that suddenly people have to make things in precisely the same way to certain external standards in order to make the factory work. So what Winner ends up saying is that factories are essentially authoritarian because they require some authority to push out a standardized rule set and get everyone to follow it in order to get all this efficiency. And one thing to think is, maybe this is a stretch, I can't tell, but factory logic, the thing that makes factories the most important thing for the factory is that the inputs and outputs match up in numbers, right? That one side make the same number of soles and the next side make the same number of uppers, and the people that make the eyelets make 10 times, they have to make the right number, right? Or they won't match up and the factory will fall apart. And I kind of think that there's something in that factory logic which might be responsible for us being so obsessed with measurable outcomes that are clear and portable and stable, and so disinterested in the weird, non-packageable joys and values of the process.
When you're playing a game, a lot of people want to reclaim agency. And we don't always talk about reject metrics or games entirely in the book, right?
Yeah.
So instead, it really asks us to become something else. You talk about something called reflect control,
right?
And that's the ability to step back and ask, what is this game about? Why did we want to play it? Why is that question so hard when systems start feeling less official?
I mean, I think there's something natural that you can do with games, but it doesn't always happen with games. I think it's experience. I fly fish a lot, and fly fishing is delightful, but there are different methods for fly fishing. Some of them catch you more fish, some of them catch you less. One of my favorite methods is dry fly fishing, which is just beautiful, but incredibly hard, and you catch very few fish, but it's intense.
Yep.
And I was on the river, and I ran into this other guy, and he was using a different kind of fly fishing that's very efficient. It's called euro-nymphing, and some people love it.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was complaining. Do you fly fish? Do you know these?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Of course you fly fish.
Of course,
she says. So
what weight pull? That really says it. That tells me everything.
What?
Because the lighter the weight of the pole, the more accurate you have to be.
So the lighter the dry fly casting is so lovely and so requires so much out of you, but it's, you know, especially dry fly casting to a fish you can see. Euro nymphing, which let me say again, some people love, but I don't like. And this guy I ran into was like miserable, and he was sweating bullets, and he was like, I'm just not catching as many fish as I need to be, and like, you know, this euro nymphing is just so like painful. And I was like, well, you don't have to euro nymph, you can fish in a different way. And he said, but you gotta euro nymph because you catch more fish. It's more efficient. You have to do it. And I was like, what is the point? We are catch and release fishing. It does not matter how many fish we catch. The reason we're doing it is for the pleasure. And I think this is true in so many areas where we're engaged in activity for pleasure or joy or interest or community. And then we chase some score out of joy and out of community and out of interestingness just because it's the score. So that's possible even in games. But I think games make it easier because, like we were talking about before, since there's so many different games, and since games kind of invite you to modify them, it's very easy to think, oh, I don't like this game of poker. Let's house rule it. Or, you know, this game of Mario is boring to me. Let's invent a new speedrun method for it, right? Games invite tinkering. And if you tinker with them or you try different games, what you're automatically doing is reflecting. You're trying scoring systems being, this one doesn't work. This one's gross. This one's great. This one's awesome. What if we change it that way? Oh, that works better for me. Then we go to the world. And part of the problem is that the scoring systems in the world are tied to incentives. So it's really hard to step back from them, right? When our careers are on the line. But even then, there are a lot of them that aren't. There aren't, you know, when I was stuck in this hole trying to lose weight, there were no incentives tied to me losing weight, right? When I was like on, right? There are so many systems where we don't necessarily get anything. We're not incentivized to track them, but we are going to plunge ourselves into a nasty scoring system because I think a lot of the times, one of the answers is there's not variety and the world doesn't invite us to try on different scoring systems. Games are there being like, here's 100,000 different ways you could play this or score this or think about it or do this. And, you know, the university is there being like, here's GPA. That's all there is. There's no other choice. And the kind of pervasiveness of it truly, I wouldn't say disinvites us, makes us forget that there's a possibility of choice and a possibility of modification. And then it's just hard. Like you're talking about, if you try to ungrade your class and you refuse to give grades to your students, given that the rest of the world demands communication and grades, your students will be disadvantaged by your class or by being at a university that doesn't offer grades.
Now, as we're wrapping up, is there anything that you want folks to take away from this conversation or from your book?
Yeah.
What's like the number one thing?
Have not perfect, but maybe a lot of control over how you judge yourself. And sometimes the world will force on you a way of it judging you or it giving you rewards, but you don't have to take it inside. And it's very easy to adopt. The world has so many ready-made forms of judgment, from Fitbit to social media likes to weight loss programs. And each of these things is a ready-made way of judging yourself. And it's so easy to just like hop on board and just accept an external system as the center of your judgment. And I think the only thing I'm saying is games and the spirit of play is a different tendency, and it's the tendency of thinking and constantly asking yourself if a particular mode of judgment or a way of scoring yourself actually is working for you and actually getting you to what you really want, what you really want might be outside the grasp of a pre-specified scoring system.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And after today's episode, I want to leave you with this thought. You may spend years trapped in bad games, perfect GPAs, rankings, body metrics, and systems you never consciously choose. And seeing them as a game may give you something that you hadn't before, choice. So I'll leave you with the same question that the book leaves us. Is this the game you really want to be playing? Because once you see the score, you don't have to keep obeying it. So thank you for joining us on today's episode of Breaking Math. I'm Autumn Phaneuf. And until next time, keep playing games and stay curious.